Hello and welcome to the Mostly Erlang podcast, episode 3. And today we are talking about OTP framework with Francesco, as well as some of our normal crew. So, Francesco, why don't you introduce yourself to people who might not know who you are?
Hi, Zach. Thanks for having me. So, my name is Francesco Cesarini. I'm the founder of Erlang Solutions. I wrote Erlang Programming, published by O'Reilly, and I'm currently writing a book on OTP. So, building for scalability with Erlang OTP.
And Justin?
Hi, I'm Justin Sheehy. I'm the CTO at Basho. We're certainly pretty heavy users of OTP. We make a whole bunch of open source Erlang software like React, Web Machine, and so on.
Simon?
Yeah, I'm Simon St. Laurent. I'm senior editor at O'Reilly Media. I'm also the co-chair of the Fluent Conference. I'm spending my life kind of split between the functional programming world, introducing Erlang and now introducing Elixir, and the JavaScript life in the browser with a bit of Node world. So I guess I'm straddling a lot of different pieces.
And I'm Zach Kessen. I'm the author of Building Web Applications with Erlang, which Simon edited, and Francesco was kind enough to tech review. And I'm a programmer in Tel Aviv. And we actually have two announcements today before we get onto the show. So first of all, Lambda Jam, which is a conference that will be happening July 8th to 10th in Chicago, all about functional programming, has asked us to please give them a shout-out. And if you use discount code CRASH, they will give you a 10% discount. Unfortunately, I will not be able to attend, but the agenda looks amazing, so I'd recommend if anybody can be in Chicago then and would like to do it, let you go there, go to that conference. They should definitely do so. It looks like it'll be a lot of fun. And the other thing is that on October 23rd this year, we will be holding Erlang Factory Light in Tel Aviv, which I'm helping to organizing. So that's just, we just set that up today. So if any of you would like to come visit Israel and see Tel Aviv, maybe a bit of other things, we will do that. If people have and be listening has announcements they'd like us to throw in the podcast, or Erlang related, please just send us an email or leave a comment. And of course, the Erlang User Conference. Francesco, why don't you plug that one?
Okay, well, we've got the Erlang User Conference in Stockholm in early June. We've got over 50 speakers, including, the three inventors of Erlang on stage at the same time on one keynote. We've got Klaus Wikström, who created Amnesia, Erlang Distribution, the Yours web server, and the serial entrepreneur having another keynote. We've got Bruce Tate, author of 7 Languages in 7 Weeks. We've got a long, long list of speakers, and the conference is, 4 tracks, 8 tracks over 2 days, plus a whole day, filled with tutorials. So, very welcome. You'll find more information on the erlang-factory.com website.
And we will put a links to both of those in the show notes so people can find them. Okay, so on to our main topic, OTP. Francesco, why don't you just sort of explain what OTP is and how it came about, and we'll start just talking about it.
Well, more than OTP, if you go back to when Ericsson started working on the very, very first product written in Erlang, that was in 2002. Early on, they realized that, Erlang is a language with a lot of really good features. I mean, I'd assume they're features you've been discussing in the previous podcast, but, they were looking, it's open source, it's concurrency oriented, it's got lightweight processes, asynchronous message passing, share nothing model, and a lot of other really good features. But at the end of the day, it's just a programming language. If you need to start writing systems which are distributed, which are fault tolerant, so, even if things go wrong, they'll continue working without affecting other things in the system, so the ability to isolate errors and regain control, or, ensure that your systems are highly available, systems with no single point of failure. You need more than just a programming language. You need a framework, you need middleware, and you need a way to architect your systems, ensuring that you don't go in and reinvent the wheel, from one project to another. And so very early on, so in 1993, soon after they started the first Erlang product, working on the first Erlang product, they started working in parallel on middleware to build Erlang systems. And back then it was called the Basic Operating System, BOS. And a few years later, they merged the development of BOS with the Erlang team And that's when OTP came about. So that's a bit of history. And what OTP gives you, I mean, it's usually, you know, OTP consists of three things. And it consists of Erlang, the programming language. It consists of a set of ready-built libraries and applications. And the third thing is it consists of a set of design principles. And these things together is what really gives you the power when you're developing Erlang systems.
So where, you know, to somebody just learning Erlang, where's a good place to sort of, you know, when I first learned Erlang, it was just this huge thing, you know, it was kind of intimidating. So what's the, a good place for a beginning programmer to sort of start looking at this thing and figure out how to, you know, make efficient use of it?
So, I mean, there are two approaches, and one is just to start using OTP without understanding what's going on, without the need to understand what's going on behind the scenes. And that is one approach. And there's a really good book, Erlang OTP in Action, which covers it. On the other side, it's published by Manning. On the other side, if you're interested in OTP, interested in understanding what's going on behind the scenes, the first step there is actually to go in and understand Erlang, understand the concurrency in Erlang and how concurrency is built, and burn your fingers a few times doing, you know, basic errors most people will do with concurrent programming. And at that point, when you start using OTP, you'll realize that all of the borderline cases and all of the mistakes you've actually done are handled for you behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's, Francesco, it's funny you put it that way. That's exactly what I did, right? Because I'm sort of one of these weird people that's neither in the old guard of Erlang nor in the new crowd. So when I learned it, the only book out was the now well out of print one by Joe, right? The extended version of the original Erlang doc. There was no good documentation on OTP. I mean, there were official docs, but they weren't very good. And I had no one teaching me. So I learned Erlang really without using OTP at all at first.
Yeah.
You know, and I did learn about the concurrency basics and how everything works, but I sure as heck did write a lot of really bad Erlang code as a result, I think. You know, I think that OTP really captures a lot of the fundamental right, useful ways to write Erlang. And, you know, I think, you know, today I would recommend strongly that people not take that same path that I did now that, especially now that there are good books and people like yourself and others teaching good classes and so on how to start with OTP as one of their tools. I don't mean people shouldn't learn about the concurrency primitives underneath, but I feel like I had also some things to unlearn when I switched to trying to do things the OTP way.
Exactly. Yeah. I think OTP was very much built with 9-to-5 programmers in mind. So programmers who will go in, they'll do a good job, but at 5 p.m. exactly, stamp out and stop thinking of the problems. They start... You know, they don't walk home thinking, have I covered all the borderline cases? Are there any edge conditions which will cause issues? And that's with those programmers in mind, that's when OTP was built. And, you know, and it speeds up the whole development as a result.
And even for those of us who are not 9-to-5 programmers, you know, having those cases handled for you has a couple of benefits. First of all, it means that, you know, the edge case you didn't think of is still covered, and there's always a few. It also means that, you know, you just don't have to think about that part of the problem. You know, it's sort of like when you moved from a language like C to a language that had garbage collection, like, you know, a Java or Ruby or whatever. Suddenly you don't have to worry about memory management anymore, and you can actually focus on the actual problem your customer cares about. So I see this as the next sort of another progression along that same line. We have a framework to give us infrastructure, and we can actually solve spend our time writing code to solve the actual problem.
I think OTP actually has an advantage over most of the frameworks I've dealt with, though. I mean, obviously, I spend a lot of time in JavaScript, and there are just too many frameworks doing the same thing. It's incredibly freeing for me to come to Erlang and find that there is this one, you know, coherent set of tools that is not quite baked into the language, but definitely available in every Erlang context. So, you know, I think the Erlang community is extremely lucky to have this coherent approach available everywhere. It feels very, very different to me.
Yeah, I guess I think of it as somewhere between what I think of as a framework and a library. You know, in that when someone says framework to me, I tend to think of all these things that are basically really useful if what you want to do is make an application that's essentially just a rebranding of an application the framework author made. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you want to do something that's actually a fundamentally new application, most frameworks are completely useless to you and you have to start over.
Yeah, they tend to follow a very severe bathtub curve where, you know, you're doing something that they thought of, it's really easy, but as soon as you take two steps out of that, it goes, you know, the workload just goes up the wall.
Exactly. And OTP does certainly have some, you know, pretty clearly expressed opinions about how to structure some things about your applications, right? Having the mm-hmm. application module, the supervisor module, and all these things, but not really about the sort of overall shape and structure of your application. And that's one of the things I think is, you know, lets us use it for such radically different things.
Yeah, their opinion's at the right level of abstraction. They don't get in your way.
Yeah.
I mean, there are two things, you know, you can, you know, either spend a lot of time solving problems, which are, you know, problems because you're not using the right tool. And, you know, I talk about 9-to-5 programmers. I do it in a positive way because it allows programmers to actually think about what is really hard in the problem they're solving. And it's a hard problem irrespective of the tool they pick. And that's really where OTP comes in and really shines.
Yeah, you have this, as frameworks go, the other thing is it's, unlike a lot of frameworks I've used, it seems very mature because it's been around a long time and very well thought out. I mean, having used some of the JavaScript frameworks and some of the PHP frameworks and spent a little time cursing at Rails, it just seems refreshingly solid.
Well, I think a lot of that is, you know, back to what we were saying a minute ago, most of those, you know, frameworks you're now talking about are really someone essentially cutting and pasting and making more generic the code that they use to write some application. It's rare that you see one of those frameworks that's really about solving sort of deeper structural problems. You know, I think it happens occasionally, but not often in the realm of what people usually call frameworks.
Right. If you look at, say, a Backbone.js, which I rather like, you know, it's very explicitly Jeremy Ashkenaz has pulled it out of his development work on the Document Cloud project and just sort of said, well, I think this will be useful for people. You know, have at it, guys. Which, you know, is great if it happens to be useful, which I think it is for certain threats or problems. You know, OTP seems a much more solid, reliable thing. It just, you know, you can sort of count on a service working.
Yeah. The other thing I'd get back to, I mean, you can count on the service working. You can also count at this point on finding documentation that explains things and explains them well. You know, I was lucky to come to Erlang at a time when Francesco had already written his book on Erlang and Joe had his book on Erlang. The Logan book certainly added a lot of stuff about OTP.
And of course, as Fred's learned you some Erlang, which is also wonderful.
Which has just got some spectacular examples with band managers. The, you know, for somebody just walking into a framework, there are so many good options and they really beautifully overlap each other. They don't, you know, compete the same way that I find with a lot of other framework documentation. And I think in this case, maturity is definitely something to be appreciated.
So Justin, how do you guys use OTP within the framework of RIAC?
We use it very, very heavily. So, you know, RIAC is made up of many OTP applications, right? So if you look at the rebar config at the top level of React and React KV, you'll see that there's actually a number of OTP level applications that are pulled in both top level and as dependencies of dependencies. And before we even get to how the OTP libraries themselves help, having that common application structure that, you know, a new developer at Basho can look at, and all of those large subpieces of our products are going to be laid out in a standard way is really useful. And if they've been doing Erlang at another, you know, discipline shop, it's probably the way they're used to. That alone, even before we get to like how the actual code of OTP helps, is a pretty big deal. But I think we use, you know, OTP pretty across the board. There's some parts that we used and then moved away from because it turned out that they didn't fit what we were using them for. You know, for instance, we used to have some gen events in React that it turned out were, you know, going to have a performance profile that didn't work for the way we were using it. But we certainly use gen servers all over the place and gen FSMs. You know, I think that some of the request handling FSMs in React are some pretty interesting examples of a gen FSM behavior. We've certainly from time to time implemented our own behaviors, which I know is more an Erlang thing than just about OTP, the higher level. But I think of it as being OTP flavored as a way to build your application.
And I think, you know, the way you've built it is very similar to the way most people use OTP. And the real advantage there is if you take someone coming from Ericsson or from GitHub or Facebook or T-Mobile or any other company using Erlang, when they start looking at, you know, the download React and they start looking at the code, they just need to focus on the specifics because they'll understand all of the generics because it's the same everywhere you go.
Yeah.
Infrastructure. And so the learning curve ends up becoming much less steep than what it otherwise would be.
Yeah, for our project, our software here, I've taken a few things that are kind of generic and just stuck them up on GitHub as open source, and they're simply in our rebar config file as a dependency, and it just grabs them. So that's nice, and I actually even have a few things that are fundamentally just JavaScript or data that still look like an OTP app. They just, you know, basically have an empty source directory and a bunch of stuff in the priv directory, and then, you know, it just... if whatever uses them just says, okay, it's, you know, here's how you find the appropriate directory, and it just does the right thing.
Yeah, and we've certainly found that, you know, over time, especially as we've gotten, you know, more used to the strengths and weaknesses of the different parts of OTP, that, you know, some of those tools in that toolbox we reach for, you know, more often than others. But it's, you know, the level of existing, working, reliable power you get out of, say, the GenFSM behavior is a really big deal. And just being able to pick that up and, you know, have a working one without any of the grunt, gritty, hard work of making it, its fundamentals work, it has absolutely been a big deal in, I think, making React, you know, a really robust system that we've been able to grow really fast.
And especially if you're using Emacs as your editor, which at least I do, you have the advantage that Emacs will happily generate a functional gen server that, I mean, you know, you can basically just generate the template, compile it, and run it, and it'll run. It won't do anything, but it'll run.
And, yeah, to me, though, the big deal is that the thing it generates isn't much text, right? You know, whether or not you can auto-generate it, the fact that there isn't actually much work to be done to get there by that editor is, I think, an even bigger deal, right, in that the reader of that, right? I'm actually a little less concerned, although it's obviously important, with the guy that wrote that gen server in the first place than I am with the second and third person that come along and look at it. And they don't have to separate all of the, you know, work that would have been repetitive from the domain specific.
Yeah. Plus,
I think, sorry if I'm interrupting, but what you're saying here was actually reinforced by a study they did at Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh. What they did is they went in and rewrote a C++ application written by Motorola into Erlang. And their conclusion was that depending on how you counted, Erlang was 4 to 20 times less code than its counterpart in C++. And they reached 20 times less code when you went in and actually assumed that OTP was part of Erlang and part of the standard libraries. And that's the type of reduction of code, you know, you'd be seeing on, and allowing the programmer just to focus on the specifics and not worry about the generics, not having to understand the generics at all.
Yeah, that's exactly, I mean, it's nice to have that study backing it up, but that's exactly the feeling I was talking about. And the reference to a standard library in C++, you know, really evokes the way I think of OTP. You know, if we back up and think about Erlang for itself for a minute, you know, I tend to think of Erlang as probably the one of the best languages out there at being object-oriented in any reasonably defined way. Certainly far better at it than, say, Java or C++ or anything like that, since, you know, processes are better in basically any way than instances of classes. And if you start thinking that way, then I think of OTP as, you know, a far better thing to have as a class library than anything you could build in the sort of inheritance sort of system, you know, with behaviors and so on.
Yeah. The one thing that I sort of got difficult was, you know, it was fairly obvious when I was reading the docs of how you built a supervisor that had one or two or a fixed number of processes running, but how to get something that had sort of a dynamic processes that come and go as, you know, needed was a little less harder to figure out. I eventually did figure it out, but that's something that, you know, I'm sort of trying to figure out that you can use this not just for something that you have, you know, one server running that's, you know, handling some service for the everything else, but where you have something where, you know, processes are being generated to handle event by the system to deal with stuff and then going away when it's done. So that's something that, you know, was not obvious to me at first.
There was a lot that wasn't obvious to me at first. It came along pretty quickly, but I guess I want to ask maybe a rude question. The OTP library is very stable. It has lots of great parts. Justin mentioned that there are some parts that, you know, they use more than others. I guess my question would be, are there parts you actually feel like you have to work around, or parts that you feel you have to extend differently, or is it all really that beautifully smooth?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. There's certainly significant parts of it that we and I don't use much at all. In most cases, I think that's because the particular types of applications that I tend to be close to aren't the ones those libraries were designed for. And that's where this does feel a little bit more like a framework than a library sometimes, right? Which is that, you know, there's a bit of opinion in there. And if I want to build something that differs from that opinion, I shouldn't use that piece of OTP. Right. And that's, you know, what I think the Genevent example was about. But over, you know, there have definitely been examples of people finding, you know, the existing behavior is not suited to what they need, but close, right? For a while, we saw, I think it was the eJabberDee folks that first, at least noticeably used, that did their own variation on Gen Server that had really, really different handling of its incoming mailbox, for instance. So it was a fairly subtle implementation detail difference with the same interface. And, you know, we've done some things like that with some unusual supervisors, for instance, where we want to do different things with, you know, maybe thinking about the limits on how many children or workers you might want to spin up but still be dynamic. So, you know, I think that it's certainly not, you know, sort of one of these things that perfectly smooth for all uses. But I've found even the places where it hasn't fit to be insightfully designed, even if not matching with what I've looked for.
I mean, you have the possibility of writing your own behaviors, which is, well, pretty much what I think Justin is describing here. And it's very seamless to do. It's, you know, you don't need that much code to actually hook into your whole supervision structure and reap all the benefits you get from OTP in a behavior which follows the design patterns you need. So I mean, I'd say OTP will cover probably 95% of the functionality you need, and remaining 5%, you either use the existing behaviors or you roll out your own.
Or you just look on GitHub and you find
someone already done your homework. That's right.
You find that, you know, Justin implemented it, or one of his guys at Basho, or the eJabberDee guys did it, and you just sort of grab their implementation.
Exactly.
But I even think that the most important point, Francesco, that you just made is not what the percentages are, but the fact that, and this is again a difference from most things people call frameworks, that it's not all or nothing. You don't have to be using OTP or not using OTP, right? You can use however much of it suits your own system and write your own code wherever you don't want to use it.
The other thing we haven't talked about is OTP supports the Gen servers and other things support code upgrades. So why don't we talk about how to do that for a bit?
Well, if you look at code upgrades, they look simple on paper. What you do is you upload a new module into the Erlang VM and you do a fully qualified function, and hey ho, your next thing you know is you're running the latest version of the code. And so it's really easy to explain. It's really easy to demo, but you know, think in terms of a system with a couple million lines of code. You've got a major release. You've got new functionality. You've got a database schema change. You have non-backwards compatible protocols. You've got state changes in your processes. and all of this in a distributed environment, all of a sudden your software upgrade becomes much, much more complicated than what you originally thought. It's not just a question of a simple module. It's a question of coordination. And that's where OTP will provide you with the functionality to actually go in and do your upgrades in a fairly controlled way.
So I do think it's one of the harder things to get right in an interesting system, even with everything OTP gives you, right? OTP gives you far more for this purpose than anything else out there that I've ever known, right? There's very few runtimes that let you load hot code in the first place, but then what OTP gives you for upgrades is way beyond anything else I've seen in that regard. But even with that, making an interesting system be hot upgradable in a, you know, reliable way is pretty darn hard. And I think the best that I've seen someone describe and talk about the, you know, the reality of doing this is probably some of the things from Joe Williams at Boundary, talking about how they do that and have done that with a bunch of their Erlang systems in the past, and the, you know, the little additional things that they've written to help them and so on.
Yeah, it's not an easy problem in a running system.
No, I mean, I spend some time with our Velocity folks and the DevOps people, and, you know, I have these long conversations about the headaches they go through, and I'm like, well, there could be a book in that. And then I look at the Erlang books, and I'm like, wait, it's a chapter, but that only works in Erlang.
I'm actually surprised not more, not more programming languages have picked up ideas. They're picking up a lot of ideas around Erlang when it comes to the concurrency models, you know, distribution models, but I still haven't seen anyone pick up all of the ideas around software upgrade.
You know, I used to work for this company that whenever they did a software upgrade, it was a games company. They had to take the servers offline for, you know, multiple hours. And of course, you know, these are the companies, these are the servers that are the company.
I get it all the time when I go online on my bank, on my web bank. We want to do web banking. It's more often than not, oh, sorry, your service is down for a few hours. We're doing an upgrade. I mean, that's embarrassing in this day and age.
Right.
Where, you know, you can do it, you know, you don't even need software upgrade to handle it, but, yeah.
I mean, you can do it in Ruby. The Ruby Rogues guys had a podcast episode about that, how to do this with Ruby on Rails. I don't know if it's quite as elegant as Erlang, but it can, you know, they have thought about it, at least to a certain extent.
It's just a lot harder.
I can believe it.
I think a lot of the things that are present in both the Erlang runtime and the structure of the OTP libraries and behaviors makes hot code upgrading plausible. Doesn't do it for you, but it sort of helps you not get in your own way a little bit. You know, like for instance, the fact that, you know, a long running Erlang process is expected to be running a function that is going to go forever via tail calls, right? This sounds like a tiny little subtle thing, but it matters enormously here. First off, if your runtime doesn't have tail call optimization, then that means it, you know, missed out on the last 30 years of programming languages development and is missing a basic feature, and you can't do this. But one of the things that lets Erlang do is have a nice, clean moment in any given process's life when it's calling its own function again, and that function can be switched to the next version of that function as you upgrade. Right. Now, you still have to write the interesting domain-specific logic of, you know, what else should change when that code version changes. But the fact that you have that moment in a well-defined way is a big deal and is only possible to be done that way because of some underlying choices in the runtime.
Yeah, you just get the feeling that the guys at Ericsson who designed Erlang just were really on the ball and seemed to have gotten a huge number of things really right with the language.
It didn't happen overnight. It happened after, you know, many, many, many years of prototyping and, you know, through trial and error. But
oh, yeah.
I agree with you in full. They did get a lot of things right as a result of their activities. I mean, they went in and they invented a language which solves a particular problem. They didn't invent a language and then try to find a domain of application for it. And yeah, and that's what makes all the difference.
It just happens to be that the problem they were solving, which is telecom of the 1980s, looks a lot like the problem I'm trying to solve, which is, you know, internet services of 2013. You know, a lot of the characteristics of the two are very similar, even if the
you know, the details vary, but, you know, they're solving the same general types of problems. So it maps really well. All right. Just want to, you know, one last thing to cover that, you know, I'm talking about things like concurrency, the ability to upgrade, the ability to not be offline. So, I mean, those are the types of things that, you know, they were trying to deal with the idea that you have to be able to upgrade a system without taking it offline. You know, you can't knock half a city's phone grid offline to fix a bug. You know, that's what I was talking about in terms of what problems they were trying to solve. And of course, you know, if you're running an online company, sort of the same thing, you want to leave your servers online, which are making you money, while fixing bugs or in the future. So one more thing to cover is, just more before we finish, supervisors. Supervisors are the sort of generic supervisor is sort of another thing sort of we should touch on. And we should probably do a full episode on it later maybe, but we should at least touch on it.
So, I mean, supervisors is what allows errand programmers not to worry about errors and about corrupt data and software bugs. It allows them to focus on programming for the correct case and not being defensive. And you know, the beauty in a supervisor is that no matter what the error is, you will handle the error in a standardized way. And, you know, this, by not having to, you know, worry about certain borderline cases and about bugs and corrupt data, and you're letting your process terminate and letting your supervisor deal with it, you know, will result in even less code. And I think, you know, I posted two links on the Motorola project I referenced earlier, where they rewrote C++ applications in Erlang. And what they did is they went in and counted how many lines, counted lines of code and what every single line of code did. And in the C++ application, about 25% of the code was defensive programming or error handling. The counterpart in Erlang was 1% of the code. So just there, you've removed 25% of your code base, which you don't have to worry about.
And of course, your error handling code can have bugs in it just like any other code. So then how do you handle the bugs in the, you know, when the error handling code generates its own errors, you have, you know.
It's not people trying to handle borderline conditions and error cases usually end up introducing even more errors. So yes, I think that's a really good way of putting it.
Well, and I think that supervisors and, you know, even the underlying things like links and monitors that make them possible, you know, really illuminate what's missing from almost everything else that describes itself as Erlang-like, right? You know, it's not just about the ability to send some messages or create some lightweight processes. The ability to think in this way and create things cheaply that can also die cheaply. And here I mean cheaply in terms of, you know, how much effort you have to put into dealing with that and how predictably it happens is really, to me, one of the fundamental reasons to use Erlang, and that's, you know, not straightforward to get to, even if you took all the supervisor code with something that doesn't provide you with the primitives that supervisors use.
I mean, the other thing is that, the sort of standard supervisor is, you know, it's basically an init function that, I mean, it's like a start, leak, and an init that just returns a data structure, basically, and then the supervisor module itself takes care of that and turns that into, you know, does the appropriate things. So what I was wondering was, when I was starting to play with, you know, using these, starting to write, do test-driven development around Erlang, do people write unit tests for supervisors? Because I tried it, and it just kind of felt silly.
It's an interesting area of research. The way it's been handled until recently is you went in and manually killed processes, and what you would do is you wouldn't be testing the supervisors. You would actually be testing the recovery strategy of your system. Is your system able to recover and act predictably even under when your processes are terminating abnormally? And today, you know, they've taken a step forward. There is a chaos monkey which you just let loose, and it will go in and randomly kill your processes and test them. And I think that's how you actually do it. I'm not aware of actually the test cases being written to test supervisors because, you know, you've got an infinite combination.
Well, I'm just talking about just the init function that, you know, just you sort of set up the couple, you know, here are the tasks that I want created. You know, it's a list. It's just a big data structure. It's just basically construction returns a big data structure.
Well, I guess my question there is more a criticism of the whole idea of TDD for everything. If you've written a function that's a couple lines long and just makes a data structure and returns it, what exactly do you learn from a test about that. I'm, by the way, very, very in favor of all kinds of testing and tons of it. But I also think it's possible to have a little bit of religion here that causes people to do things that don't help them sometimes.
Yeah, that's sort of, I agree with you. Because I did that once, and I was writing a supervisor for, I don't know what it was for something. And then I wrote, you know, an E-unit test for it. And I sort of looked at this and said, this is really stupid. And I probably went and deleted it because I just figured, this, you know, it doesn't really do anything useful. It's not going to tell me that my supervisor isn't doing the right thing.
The thing that I keep finding, it's been interesting getting responses to introducing Erlang, mostly from people who've been used to other languages. And I get this kind of disbelief that, you know, let it crash could possibly be a good strategy, that error handling, you know, should be simple, that supervisors can just let great relief I feel in Erlang is that I don't have to worry about those things anymore. I can just let them go. But letting them go is more than just learning the language. It's kind of adjusting yourself to fit it. And so I think people are bringing testing assumptions from elsewhere. People are bringing error handling assumptions from elsewhere. It's probably worse when they try to take Erlang concepts back to their own, to the languages they're trying to improve and mash them there. But it's such a cultural leap that it's hard to understate. And it makes for some great bar conversation, but it can be really confusing to people.
No, I agree, Simon. I think that there is a big cultural shift there, right? I mean, if I look at something in a language like Erlang or, you know, or ML or Haskell or anything like that, and I see a short, essentially declarative function that just, you know, creates a literal data structure, I immediately know that that specific function on its own probably actually doesn't need extensive testing. It needs to be clear and it needs to be correct, but that might not be improved by a unit test. But if you come from a culture where, you know, people are used to doing ridiculous, you know, monkey patching sorts of things to every function in the standard language, you can't even count on that, right? So there is a culture tied to almost every, you know, language and family of programming out there that affects this as well.
Although even when I do JavaScript, I tend to do a lot of, you know, short declarative one-line code, one-line functions in my code, just because I agree with you. And of course, if you do write a lot of one- and two-line functions, transformation functions, which I do, you know, as you mentioned, if you are going to unit test them, it tends to be really short unit tests because, you know, there's only so many things you can do in two lines of code. So I tend to write a lot of short functions that are composable and just compose them together, which I find makes life enjoyable. Anybody else want to throw anything else in before we get to the picks?
I think the one thing I would add on the supervisor structure that Francesca reminded me of a minute ago when mentioning restart strategies is I have found the supervisor restart strategy that people use tends to be one of the most likely things in Erlang app to just be cargo culted or cut and pasted from the last Erlang code they saw. I'm not quite sure why this is true, but it seems like all of the, you know, parameters in the strategy, you know, the all for one and how many times to allow restarts and the whole restart strategy seems to be one of those things that if you look across someone's, you know, body of recent Erlang work, except not everybody does this, to be clear, but I think it's very common to have that be used as beyond boilerplate.
It's probably the Emacs skeletons. Actually, you straight out.
Yeah, well, the truth is, you know, in many cases, the sort of Emacs defaults are not totally, you know, totally crazy. They do, you know, sort of get you a reasonable place to start, but you're right. And I think we should do a future episode on supervisors and how to do them effectively.
Absolutely. It's, you know, I'm writing right now, when designing for scalability with Erlang OTP, I'm writing right now the chapter on supervisors, and I'm covering all of the different restart strategies and when you would use, you know, one for one, rest for one, one for all, you know, giving concrete examples on each of them, because I don't think it's been done to that level of detail.
No, I don't think so.
So, you know, you look at the manual pages for supervisors, two pages, writing away, you know, easily reach 20 pages just describing how you use the supervisors.
Exactly. I don't think that people generally feel like they have much guidance or understanding unless they're in a very small set of people on how to make their decision about those strategies, how to use them to their best.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's something to, you know, people have, you know, I think we need more education and more materials out there.
It is a steep learning curve, but it's not because OTP is hard. It's because the problems you're trying to solve with OTP are extremely hard.
Yeah, and frequently the sort of education we get in schools and whatever really was not built around this. They were, you know, the idea of, you know, how do you solve these problems is not something we've gotten really good at teaching yet. Never mind doing, whatever, you know. It's something we're still learning and we're still trying to figure out. And I think Erlang is ahead of most things, but that doesn't make it, again, it doesn't make it easy. All right. Shall we get to the picks? Justin, why don't you start?
I think, be your weakest picker at the end here, since I tend to just mention whatever I'm thinking of when it comes up during the talk.
Okay.
I mentioned earlier that, and I gave you the link, that Joe Williams, I think, has done some good work on a code upgrade, which is one of the harder things to do well in OTP. And I really think people should go and, you know, watch his talk and look at some of his code.
Simon?
Sure. I have a kind of a more abstract one. There's a mailing list on Google Groups called Philosophy in the Time of Software, and it's somewhat philosophical, but it's also one of the few places I've seen that really took object-oriented programming, asked what it meant, took it through a few different iterations of different people and what they meant by it, and it's good to see that people, you know, recognize not necessarily an Erlang conception of object-oriented programming yet, but certainly that there's a lot more to the conversation.
Francesco?
I want to suggest, I mean, there's Justin and I, together with Andy Gross, wrote a chapter for a book called The Architecture of Open Source Applications, where we looked at React and Erlang OTP, but more than anything, focusing on OTP. And I think it's a very interesting read for anyone who wants to learn more about the subject.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it. It looks really good. So I have one pick. It's kind of silly today. If you haven't read it yet, it's a blog post. It's been around a while. It's by James O'Reilly, I guess it's pronounced Steve. It's called The Brief, Incomplete, and Mostly Wrong History of Programming Languages. Pretty much what it says it is. It's brief, incomplete, and mostly wrong, but very funny. So, you know, if you want a good programming-related giggle, it's a good place to go look. So
I think James really likes riling people up.
Yeah, but it's funny. Any last words before we end the call? Anyway, okay, so Francesco, thank you for joining us. And
thanks for having me.
We will have you back for future episodes. We've got a lot of good stuff planned, and I know a lot of it's stuff you care about in terms of building the Erlang community. So we will have you back, and you're welcome to join us anytime you happen to be free on, you know, roughly this time on a Thursday.
Looking forward to it.
And we will have this updated on the link. And come to Erlang UserConf, and there's various Erlang Factory Lights that are happening. So the Erlang community is doing stuff. And we will talk to you again next week.